The Baltimore County School Board have decided to expel Dexter from the entire public school system.
Mr. Kirk, I'm as upset as you to learn Dexter's 2 and 3. But surely expulsion is not the answer.
I'm afraid expulsion is the only answer. It's the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane.
Welcome to Oil Ellis and Security Podcast. I'm your host, Kieran.
And I'm Dick Turnip.
Dick Turnip. Yeah, this is our first security podcast for oilellison.org. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the one.
.org. That's Dick Turnip's personal domain, which shall be the jettison host of our future podcasts. So how you doing, Dick?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I'm good. I've just pulled the sofa around in front of the chair in front of the computer for the first podcast. Get nice and comfortable. Got a cup of tea on the side.
Get cozy. I've got a cup of tea of a nice brew here rolling. I've got rooibos. I think that's how it's pronounced. Rooibos tea. It's Redbush African tea. I don't know if you ever drank it before. It's pretty tasty.
Yeah, I've had Redbush tea. It's not really for me. I like
tea. See, I don't really. I meant to, because I'm on detox and I meant to drink herbal teas. I think green tea tastes like crap. And then there's other teas, they just don't taste that nice, you know. But this Redbush tea, it's not bad. And then there's the chamomile tea, or chamomile, however you pronounce it. That's not bad too. But I like Redbush. It's decent.
Yeah, it's no caffeine, isn't it?
It's maybe really yes, it's caffeine free. That's it, yeah. That's it. So
have you tried white tea?
What's it called?
White tea, you know, just like white tea.
Just normal tea?
Yeah, well, no, it's a special...
Oh, it's a special white, it's actually white tea.
Yeah, I'm not a tea aficionado.
Me neither. Yeah, no, I can't say that I have. I've drank many, because I tell you, I used to just drink normal tea. Just like a normal cup of tea for a normal person with milk. But then when I was working for AOL, the canteen had a variety of different crazy teas. So I got bored drinking like normal tea and I start, you know, testing, sampling the goods, as it were. And I tried out all the different varieties of teas. But yeah, I quite like the Redbush one, so I've stuck to that ever since.
Good stuff.
Yeah. So we've got some news for you today on our first Oil Ellis and Security podcast. I don't know if you've been reading the news today, Dick. But it seems that kernel.org's server Hera was compromised, and it looks like they added a Trojan to the startup file for, you know, the startup scripts, obviously to give backdoor access to the system.
Is kernel.org, is that part of, that's to do with Linux, isn't it? Am I right?
Yeah, that's like the repository for the Linux kernel. So They stated that they don't believe any of the source code was affected or changed. But if it was, it means that anyone who compiled a kernel off the kernel.org repositories means that they would have been affected by whatever changes were made to the source code. So they don't know at the moment. They're still checking, still verifying all the source code to make sure it hasn't been altered. It's just as well I haven't updated my kernel in the last few weeks. So it's only they haven't given us a specific date from what I can see from when it happened. But I'm assuming I'm safe anyways.
See, that's not something that is really my forte, so to speak, because I just download Ubuntu and whack it on. And
well, that's the way it is. I mean, a lot of the distributions today, they'll give you the update. They'll update the kernel for you. But before, or I mean, some of it's still a lot of variants of Linux today. You still have to compile your own kernel. So a lot of people, stuff like Ubuntu is great. It's user friendly, but at the same time, a lot of people find it bloated. So they like to kind of download the Linux kernel and the GNU tool set, and kind of just build up their own kind of basic distribution, and then build on what they want and not have. Because when you've got stuff like Ubuntu and there's such a large code base, the potential for vulnerabilities is larger than something like Debian, which has its source code is maintained in such a way that it's secure, it's the same as the FreeBSD. The code source code is maintained, the releases are maintained efficiently, so it's a more secure way of releasing the operating system. But I suppose time will tell whether or not the source code has been changed. It seems all the WikiLeaks, the cables, all those American cables have been released recently by Julian Assange.
Now, this seems to me, this is a strange one, I think. I think basically, in my humble opinion, WikiLeaks seems to have went a bit by. I know they're still being active, but they haven't generated the sort of major publicity that they had when they first, came on the scene, but when they released the capital murder video. When they released all the diplomatic cables, the redacted ones for the first time around. Now, leaving the names and stuff like that of certain individuals in, I think they've redacted one name out of the whole 250,000 cables. Now, I think that's just a bit of bitterness on Assange's part. I think he's maybe trying to drum up more interest in WikiLeaks again, seeing as how it's sort of faded into the shadows a bit.
Well, that's what happens. They've lost traction. There's pros and cons of WikiLeaks. Obviously, disclosure, honesty, and transparency is needed, especially in today's world of politics, which is just—it's riddled with backdoor deals. And even though the public kind of knows what's going on, they don't have proof. But these leaks are—they're backing all that up. The row now is between the Guardian, the newspaper over there in England, and then Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Now, what Julian Assange is saying is that David Lee. He's one of the writers for The Guardian. He wrote that book a while back about WikiLeaks. He's saying that he revealed the key to unlock the archives, basically, of the cables. And he's saying because of that, that's why they had to release the cables. So they're all unredacted. There's names private credentials that are going to be released to the public domain. And I don't know, I haven't read through, obviously, all 250,000 cables, but I'm assuming that some people's positions in work could be affected, some people's lives may be in danger, I'm not sure. So it's a hard one to call, because like I said, there's the pros and cons. The pros is obviously there's transparency, the cons is that, you know, some people's lives are going to be affected by this, but what do you do?
I mean, I'm all for transparency and openness and, you know, I think we need these platforms where people can whistleblow leak information, because it lets the government know that we're still here, we still have a voice, we're watching, and we're not going to let people get away with these things. But the whole WikiLeaks saga, it's kind of strange. I mean, I've read the book by David Lee, and I read half of, was it Daniel Domberg Schmidt? Is it Daniel Domberg Schmidt? Probably shouldn't have said that. his book Inside WikiLeaks, it's very sort of character attacking on Julian Assange, and I think once Julian Assange came so much into the spotlight, it became more about Assange and Assange's little empire and how much control that he had over, well, not control over governments, but how much influence he had as a media sort of mogul. And it just sort of killed the whole WikiLeaks thing for me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it did surround, there was a lot of focus on Assange himself, but then at the same time, you're thinking, is that an ad hominem attack to attack the character, the personality of Assange, to take away the focus from WikiLeaks and from the, obviously, a lot of the work, what they were doing was good, credible work. It was something that was needed, that was required in today's political spectrum. But you're wondering, is it a case of Assange bringing focus on himself, or is it a case of the media bringing the focus on Assange to distract from the work of WikiLeaks? It's hard to say, but that's why there's a breakaway from WikiLeaks. I think it's called OpenLeaks. Now, I'm not even sure if they've released any material yet, but there's questions now as to whether WikiLeaks will continue to run, and they're looking in Australia now. They're looking to bring Assange to trial for releasing the cables that were submitted from the Australian embassy. So he could see he could see time from this now. You know, he probably thinks it's a price to pay for what he feels to be transparency of politics. So,
I mean, it's not the first time that Assange has been in trouble. I've just got to correct myself as well. It's Daniel Dom Scheidberg.
Okay.
I thought it was called Domberg Schmidt or something before.
Close enough.
It's what I do. I just make up names for people. Yeah. Julian Assange has been in trouble before. I read the, was it Tales from the Underground, Hacking Madness and...
Yeah, that's right.
Sulit Dreyfus, and Julian Assange was one of the researchers on it, and he was in trouble with the authorities because he was under the name of Mendax.
Mm.
That was his handle.
Okay.
In the Australian underground, and he did quite a righteous hack, actually, for when you read the story, but...
Yeah.
I mean, he's no stranger to...
Well, I mean, he's obviously clued up in the scene. He's definitely tech savvy. That's for sure.
I mean, I suppose it's a good thing. I mean, if you know, it's good that people are pushing for transparent openness, because a lot of people in government are bastards.
Indeed, yeah. Well, I haven't had time. I mean, most of the cables are unclassified. So does that mean who wants to read unclassified cables? You may as well have been reading, you know, love letters between two gobshites, you know. I was looking at the secret cables. Some of them are interesting, actually. I mean, especially in Ireland, there was a controversy about the rendition flights that were landing in Shannon, because Ireland is technically a neutral country. There was American planes stopping over from Iraq and Afghanistan, but we objected. The public basically said, and our government said, that we don't want anyone that were on the flights, we didn't want them to be sent off to Guantanamo Bay. So the American government were saying that, look, they're not rendition flights, they're just stopovers. But then, you know, the general public didn't really believe them. So there was that. So it was good to see. I mean, I saw some of the cables which discussed that topic, and they were trying to reassure the Irish government that they weren't rendition flights and so forth. So, I mean, some of it's interesting. So, I mean, probably 95% of the cables are boring, and they're irrelevant, but there's that 5% that are obviously going to be, they're going to upset a few political figureheads, you know. But
I thought some of the cables were just plain funny, like China saying, is it North Korea, saying North Korea was acting like a spoiled little child.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just
different. Yeah, some of the cables are good, some of the cables, but the majority were just boring, you know.
Well, what can you do? What can you do?
That's it. Looks like Steve Jobs resigned recently from Apple.
Not a well man, is he? He's got cancer.
Yeah, he's got serious health issues. He took that company a couple of years back, Apple was kind of going nowhere. They were just being dwarfed by Microsoft, being swallowed by Microsoft, and then he just hit the whole iPhone, iPads, OS X, and, you know, all these gadgets and gizmos start coming out, and their stock grew and grew. And now, they're even larger. What I understand is that as a company, they're larger than Microsoft and Intel combined.
Apple are huge now, but
they are absolutely huge. And even though, like, Microsoft might still have a grip on the operating system market, as a whole company, Apple is now a lot bigger than Microsoft. Which is good. I mean, that brings competition back into the world of computing, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, well, competition is a good thing, because it spurs people on to create these new inventions, come up with better operating systems, better security, you know, because that's what people are looking for in this day and age. But, I mean, with Steve Jobs not at the helm of Apple anymore, do you think they'll fall by the wayside? I mean, give Bill Gates, right, give him his due. I know Microsoft's a big evil empire and all that stuff, but when when Bill Gates was at the helm, I mean, Microsoft were quite innovative. They came up with a lot of ideas, and then, you know, Steve Ballmer got in, started sweating a lot on stage, and they sort of fell by the wayside. Do you think this will happen with Apple as well?
Absolutely. And their shares were hit hard as well. As soon as they heard Steve Jobs was resigning, it hit their shares hard, because that shows the amount of, I suppose, the amount of emphasis that is placed on Steve Jobs in terms of how important he is to the Apple brand, and to, I suppose, the creativity within Apple. But I mean, one person doesn't make a company. Now, I think Apple will continue on from this. I mean, there's obviously unheard of, you know, innovators within the Apple Corporation, and they're definitely going to grow from that.
Yeah, I mean, there's bound to be another guy with, hang on, I'm going to use a project management word, vision within the company.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? That's it. So, yeah, I was looking at the news today. There's the website of Fine Gael, which is it's the lead party in the Irish government here at the moment. Their website was hacked back in January. They had like an open portal for feedback for the public, basically, to ask questions before the election and bring attention to any issues that they wanted to find out about. But anyway, it was hacked by anonymous. They defaced the website, and there was two lads pulled in for it today by the Computer Crime Investigation Unit of the Garda Bureau of Fraud Investigation. So there's a mouthful. So two guys got pulled in, and one of them was the son of a political councillor. So it's hard to know.
So what was the method that they used for the defacement? Was it a cross site script?
I'm not really sure. As far as I remember, it was a cross site scripting attack. But hardly sure. But they defaced the website anyway. The reason for defacing it, they said, was because they were censoring questions. People were asking legitimate questions, and they were basically censoring the questions.
Well, I suppose that's fair enough, really. I mean, if they want to just put the softball answers out there, I mean, someone show the softball questions, so to speak.
Yeah.
Answer any of the hard questions. It's kind of good that someone's got them in check and, you know, let them know that they know this is going on. But
well, that's
the whole anonymous thing. I mean, anonymous kind of annoy me a bit, because I just think that anonymous like to jump on bandwagons, and when they start saying that they're responsible for Tunisia and Libya and stuff like that, really annoys me, because they're just kids behind a computer and they're not the people getting shot.
Yeah, well, that's it. And a lot of what they do is opportunism, especially in with regards to LulzSec. They're more looking at their chat log, you can see that they weren't very technically minded. They were using like SQL map and you know, automated scanners, and they were probably just mass scanning domains to find like Google Dorkin and just finding vulnerable sites, and then in hindsight they were validating trying to validate their attack to say, okay, let's say they attack some random website, they say in hindsight, oh yeah, we attacked that website because such and such, they're linked with such and such. But they, you know, that's not their motive. And everybody knows that's not their motive. Their motive is media attention. They are media whores, and that's the bones of it. All they want is attention.
I mean, well, they've probably undone a lot of good work that hackers, a lot of hacker spaces have done, you know, to turn the media image of the hacker around to say, you know, we're not all people that want to go breaking into people's bank accounts, go skimming credit card details, we don't want to fraud people. And what LulzSec's done, I mean, they've exposed a shitload of innocent people's data to the internet.
Mm.
And they've done it for media attention, and they've just fed the media the exact image that the media wants to give to the general public, which all it's going to do in the future is just ostracize the hacker community even more. And it's something
that's
could have done without.
Yeah, well, that's it. What they're really going to do is they're going to start bringing in harsher computer crime laws in across the world. And it's going to, the people who are just naturally curious and not intent on doing any sort of damage or affecting any systems, just out of curiosity, it might be a little bit shady, might be a little bit on the grey hat side, but they're not intentionally trying to destroy systems. And what's going to happen is that these people are going to get hit really hard by the law. So I think the work that what LulzSec have done and their cohorts is that they've really set the community back about 20 years. And there's been the likes of 2600 who've been working hard for years trying to improve the image of hackers. See, what the media never understand is that what LulzSec are is crackers. But they never use that term. They don't know what that term means. They lump everyone together as hackers. Hackers, to me, is someone who's just curious about software. Someone who sits down, he programs, he looks for exploits. He doesn't, what LulzSec are doing, they're using, you know, pre-compiled exploits. They're using automated scanners. It's not really hacking. It's just being a script kiddie, and they're only doing it for, they're not doing it out of curiosity. They're doing it for their own, you know, inner ego. And that's why I don't view them as hackers, but the media will, because it makes good print. I was also actually, I was pretty annoyed the fact that they DOSed the 2600 IRC server. I mean, if there was ever someone that you shouldn't DOS if you're a hacker, it's the 2600 IRC server, because those guys, they're good guys. They're generally just good guys. So I thought that was pretty lame.
Well, that's probably just to try and start off some sort of feud. But there is a well-known hacker that resides on the 2600 servers, which is the Jester. And basically, Anonymous and the Jester don't get on. And
yeah.
That's for it's
yep.
to do with that one.
Yeah, I was watching there. I had a look at the Twitter accounts. I know that the Jester, I think he was a vocal opponent of WikiLeaks. I've seen the comments back and forth between him and I think it was Sabu and Topiri. I'm not sure how you pronounce that guy's name.
Yeah, that anonymous Sabu guy, I did read an interesting document. I'm not sure if I gave you a link to it actually.
Yeah, you sent me on IRC the other day that he was involved with terrorism and.
Yeah, the whole time. I don't know how accurate it is or whatever. It's still quite interesting to read, saying that the whole, but they were drawn on parallels from was it one of Kevin Mitnick's books?
Yeah.
The two kids who went off and they started hacking, and there was this guy saying he was going to give them money, and it turned out he was part of a terrorist cell, and these kids
were
absolutely slammed for it. And it was sort of drawn parallels with that and Anonymous Sabu using people like Topiri and. Stuff like that. I mean, Tory's just a young kid. I mean, have you seen his picture, man? It's like fresh meat when he goes to jail, him, I swear.
Yeah, I read that. Was that from Art of Deception, or was one of those Mitnick books? Anyways, I read that story about the two guys, and they were being groomed online by some Middle Eastern hacker. Yeah, and I read that. It was interesting. Actually, I got Mitnick's new book, Ghost in the Wires. It's pretty interesting. I'm only through, I think I'm on the sixth or seventh chapter at the moment, but it's a bit an interesting read. I remember watching Takedown, the Hackers 2 Takedown, the movie about Kevin Mitnick. And
is that the one that 2600 petitioned against?
Yeah, that's it. They weren't happy with the story that was told about Mitnick. So this is kind of Mitnick's chance to kind of have his side of the story being released. And I'm sure they will make a film about it at some point. But it's interesting. The guy is a very smart guy. You can't deny it. And a lot of people were questioning about how savvy Mitnick was. But a lot of the stuff that he was doing a lot of people were taking the long route to attack systems, to attack servers, to compromise networks. What he was doing was he was attacking the mines. He was using social engineering to get login credentials, to get network access, and it was just that simple. He just had balls, and that's how he got access. But it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. Well, I know how it pans out, obviously, in the end. But it'll be interesting to see what other hacks he did, because the books it is pretty interesting. I know you're waiting on the Kindle version.
Yeah, well, I've got three kids, so I don't really like buying physical books, because the kids get a hold of them and they just get destroyed.
Just draw pictures on them with markers and crayons. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really sort of anal about books. I like to keep them all sort of nice and pressed.
Pristine.
Yeah.
I've got a shelf here of books, and they're just all cluttered all over the place. I'm a messy guy. But every now and again, I tidy everything up till it's spick and span. And I leave it there for another 2 months until it just becomes a complete pigsty again.
I bet it's when you're looking for something, like what you'll do. What I do is I'll have my books and I'll put them all neat, and then I'll be doing some coding or something like that, and I think, oh, I've got a book with something similar to that in, I can go and have a look at that book, and then I can't find the book, and then I start just throwing everything all over the place. And then when I do find the book I'm looking for, I'm that engrossed in what I'm doing that I'll just leave everything in the pile, much to my girlfriend's dismay. I mean, she shouts at me quite often for just because I forget, because I'm like your typical hacker, do you know what I mean? I'll get into a bit of code and then I'll just go into my own little coding world or whatever.
Yeah, I hear you. I know how that goes. I don't think you post on the boards.ie security forum, we've been running a number of security challenges on there over the past few months between myself and Damo2K. He's on IRC, the Irish 2600 IRC channel quite a bit. But Damo2K, yeah, he coded the last challenge he coded was really interesting. There was only two of us actually complete the challenge, but what he did is he set up a server and he coded a custom server. He released the binary publicly, so basically you can install a server on a virtual machine and hack it yourself. So I just wrote an exploit for it that would run on my own local machine, and then obviously I gained access to his system using the same exploit, and I just launched the interpreter shell and operated from there. But it was a lot of these war games and that they don't really provide kind of a sort of real world environment. This was a real world environment, and it involved a custom coded server. You had to write an exploit for it. You had to, compromise the server. And then even after you had a compromise, you had a shell on there, you had to take a screenshot of the desktop, and you had to get access to easy. You had a VNC a server running also. But the login credentials were stored in the VNC's configuration file. So, there was a bit of Googling involved because I wasn't familiar with the VNC server he was using. So, there was a bit of Googling involved as to where the passwords were stored and what type of encryption algorithm they were using and so forth. So, it was a really, really interesting security challenge.
That sounds like a really cool challenge. I can remember I took part in one of your web-based challenges a while ago.
Yeah.
I mean, these challenges, I mean, they're really cool. It's a legal way for people to explore, to improve their skills and to learn. There needs to be more challenges, and the one that Damo's written, it sounds like a really interesting challenge because it's not just your typical attack vectors. I mean, you've got to do a bit of fuzzing, you've got to write your own bit of shell code. Did you have to write, sorry, your own exploit?
I wrote my own exploit. So basically the way it worked was that he gave us the binary, and I had a Windows XP. Now his server was Windows XP Service Pack 3, and I just happened to have a Windows XP Service Pack 3 virtual machine. So I just ran that and installed a server. It didn't even require much fuzzing because the server didn't ask for much. It was just you entered an email address and it didn't even store it in the server. It just, it mimicked that it would store it. So basically you just overwrite the buffer, overflow the buffer, and you're overwriting the IP. I just used a Metasploit to generate the shell code. That was just for my own custom exploit. But then, I worked with Metasploit quite a bit, but not as much as I should. It's actually, the more you look at Metasploit, the more you come to understand how powerful it is. So I used Metasploit's engine using Ruby to actually create a custom exploit module for Metasploit, just using the offset, like the return address, the shell code, the sled, etc. And you load that, you can actually, and then you can call, your exploit. You can invoke it into Metasploit, and then you can use any payload that Metasploit has. So you don't have to use some custom shell code to launch a payload. You just use any of the payloads that are within the Metasploit framework, which is great. It's really easy. So I just use them Meterpreter. And just launched the shell and just worked from there. So it's really interesting. I learned quite a bit just going through the challenge itself. And I should actually work with Metasploit a bit more because it's really an amazing framework.
Yeah, and the perfect tool to work with Metasploit is Metasploitable, the custom VM. basically it's a exploitable virtual machine. It's Ubuntu 9.4, I think. Whack it in a virtual machine and away you go. It assigns an IP from your DHCP, and then you can just sort of use Metasploit and just bang away at it and bang away at it till you finally get in and get root.
Yeah. So it's just like a custom, it's like an old legacy version of Ubuntu with old services running, and you can just use Metasploit to compromise it. So that's the Metasploitable operating system. It is interesting. I think projects like this are really good, because I remember when I was starting getting into security, I must have been probably 98, 99, so I don't know what, maybe 12 years ago. I remember how hard it was to kind of, you know, get jumping into the deep end, because you didn't have the likes of Metasploit. You didn't have the likes of Metasploitable. There wasn't really any large code repository. I mean, you had BugTrack, but a lot of the exploits weren't available on there. There was no, you know, a lot of the reading that was around at the time was, you know, hacker text files from the 80s that were no longer valid. So it was kind of hard to get your foot in the door and kind of get a grasp of stuff. And I remember, it must have been around 2000 or 2001, they brought out Hacking Exposed, which was the first book to kind of give you a kind of broad, it didn't go extremely in depth into hacking, but again, it gave everyone a kind of a broad understanding of different security aspects. But then, you know, they brought out Metasploit, they brought out all these virtual machines that are custom coded to be exploitable. So you've got like Metasploitable, obviously, like you were testing, and then there's PwnOS, the Hackademia projects, and the DICDs, which are great too. So I mean, these projects are really great for just getting real world experience with security, and I think it's allowing people to become more proficient quicker than they could have done before.
Yeah, I mean, it's the OFSEC guys. I mean, they're doing some brilliant work at the moment. I mean, they're just releasing loads and loads of good stuff. They've got a new Metasploit book out through No Starch Press, which is a really good book. And they're just, like I say, they're just releasing a lot of good stuff at the minute.
I think what they're doing, and I think what's happening now to the security world, which we didn't have before, is that there's structure. There's now a form of structure to learning security, security concepts. There's a lot more structure to it. If you look at like the OFSEC security courses, they have the Offensive Security Certified Professional and Certified Expert. These are two exams. The first exam is 24 hours long. You've got 5 servers that you've got to compromise. So instead of demonstrating like ethical hacking certs and stuff like that, the ethical hacking certs and all that, they just demonstrate your ability to remember text, right? Because it's just an exam. It's like any exam, and any fool can pass an exam if you just read enough the day before and just, you know, embed it in your brain. But what the offensive security tests is that they demonstrate the ability to compromise the server, and I think that's very important. The fact that the exam, I've never seen an exam that's 24 hours long. It's for anyone that I've heard of done it. I will do it at some point myself. But anyone who's done it said it's pretty challenging. It's a pretty challenging exam, and it demonstrates real world ability to compromise a network. And I think we need that, because there's too many people masquerading as security experts. And while they might have the theory side of things down, they don't have the ability to get the job done. And that's important, especially when people are providing services as ethical hackers, you know?
Can you just say that again and bang your hand on the desk again? Get the job done.
Bit of a rant.
That was quite cool. I just heard your hand tapping away on the desk as you were saying, getting the job done. Got passionate there.
Yeah, my microphone's a bit sensitive, maybe a bit too sensitive. But yeah, as I was saying, the cert is brilliant. And it adds, like I said, it adds structure to the process of hacking, which is something that we've never had before. We've never had that structure.
I think what the OFSEC guys have done as well, they've actually took hacking and they've give it a real sort of business model, and they've found a really effective way to sell it as a product. Because that's basically, OFSEC is a security related, it's a product entity, isn't it? I mean, the guys, they must make good money off it, and something like that needs to come along, because it sort of takes it more from the underground and brings it out into the wider world, and professionals are going to get better, and they're going to be able to, well, they should be able to defend the systems better if they've got a good offense. But when it comes to like the Sony and stuff like that, I mean, obviously they haven't got many OSCPs working for them.
No, they obviously don't. But I mean, like I said, I mean, there's always this, in every field of IT, there's always been some sort of structure to learn an area. Like, you look at networking, you've got like the Cisco certification, you've got the Network Plus, stuff like that. There's always been structure for that, for learning operating systems. You've got you've got the Microsoft Certified Professionals, the MSCE, all that for Microsoft, and then obviously the Red Hat certs and so forth. So you've had, for every aspect of IP, you've always had structure to learn a specific field of IT, but there was never that structure for security. And we have that now, and I think that's important. But it's good. I mean, it's great. It's given everybody a chance to learn security, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. I know we've kind of went off track a bit with the OSCP, but I want to mention that, you know, we're talking about Metasploitable, and that for anyone who is listening that has never done anything like this before, you don't have to use an operating system like Metasploitable. You can actually create your own exploitable virtual machines by putting on vulnerable, outdated software. I mean, it's ExploitDB, Exploit Database. You can go and have a look on there. You can see what programs are exploitable, and then you can build your own custom servers for you to custom VMs for you to play with and exploit.
Yeah, absolutely. But a lot of the security challenges I set up, one was, I'm not sure if I ran it on the channel, but one was involved SQL injection. And basically the idea was that you set up some sort of a shell, some sort of like PHP web-based shell with an upload feature. And all you had to do was just check the kernel version to realize that obviously the kernel was vulnerable. And then you could set up, run an exploit. So set up maybe Netcat to listen on a port, connect, so you've got like some sort of a permanent connection, some sort of real TCP connection opposed to a web-based connection, and then you can exploit the system. So these are things, for that I just downloaded a legacy version of Ubuntu. I think it was 10.04, I can't remember off the top of my head, but that's all it takes, really. You can just download legacy versions of operating systems. They're all out there. I mean, you can even go on to... If you're not comfortable with Linux, you could go on to Pirate Bay, something like that, and download an old version of Windows XP, just for testing demonstration purposes. Just download the virtual machine and just practice attacking that with Metasploit, stuff like that. It's a good way to kind of get your lips wet.
Well, that's what hacking's all about, isn't it? It's about getting stuck in and getting your hands dirty and, coming up with your own solutions and your own ideas and sharing them with other people. And that's what I love about the hacking community. It's all about just tinkering and just playing with things and moulding them and then giving them away so people can really get into it.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. So, I mean, I like the fact, like I said, that there's structure now. And I think... I like the fact also that there's a lot of security-related work now. There's more and more pen testers out there. A lot of people are getting jobs as pen testers now, which is that's good. I mean, I believe you're training as a pen tester yourself at the moment.
Yeah. I'm going into my third year of university. I'm a mature student, obviously. Been a bit naughty when I was younger, but I've decided to turn my life around, get an education, so... third year university, and it's sort of software development side of things, which is, it's kind of good because I like to make things. I like to code. I find coding it's interesting, and I would rather be able to as well as break programs, I like to be able to create programs. And I think if you're a developer who gets into the penetration testing side of things, because you understand the whole software development process, I think it probably helps you grow as a pen tester, because you're not just putting SQL, if your web application tester, for example, you're not just sticking SQL into the URL and then not understanding really what's going on behind the scenes with the code. You know, when you're passing things to global variables or whatever, you know, the little ins and outs and how it's actually performing.
Yeah, there's a lot of people, and there's a lot that happens a lot with script kiddies, is that they remember like a sequence, like an attack vector or a sequence. Take, for example, SQL injection. They understand to find the amount of columns that they'll order by a certain amount of columns. They understand if they want to pull data, they'll use a union select statement, but they don't really understand what's happening in the background. So I think to be a programmer, to kind of understand it from a white box standpoint, to understand how the code works, why the code is affected, why it's vulnerable, that's certainly very important.
Yeah, like you say, I mean, if you know white box methodology, I mean, you have a better idea when you come to do your black box testing. But one thing I will say to anyone that's sort of listening out there that is a student and wants to get into the InfoSec field, is that you should just be brazen and approach people and say, look, I'm willing to work for free. You know, this is what I want to do. I'm dedicated. I want to get into it. I'll come in. I'll make you cups of tea. I'll make you cookies. That's how I got into it. I basically emailed a guy who's got his own company. I mean, he's a really, really nice fella, but I'd never met him before. I just saw him on Twitter, and basically I had a load of knockbacks from software development companies, so I sent him a Twitter message saying, do you take on voluntary staff? And we had a little talk on email, and then I ended up working there. Unpaid, but it's all experience, and you're constantly learning, and hopefully after I get my degree and stuff like that, I'll be able to get a job out of it.
Yeah, well, that's it. The experience is the most important thing. I mean, once you have that reference, once you have that experience, some real world experience, you can't put a price on that. And hackers are always willing to do this anyway, off their own back at home, set up labs at home, do stuff in their own time. So just the fact that you're in doing it in an office with someone else that's kind of going to mentor you and tutor you, that's brilliant. That's a great thing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you enjoy doing it, then it doesn't matter how much you're getting paid. If you haven't got, you know, sort of other commitments, you know, obviously you're not going to go from a 40 grand a year job and just say, oh, well, sack that off because I want to get into the security industry and work for free. I mean, no one in the right mind's going to do that. But if you find yourself at a loose end like I did over the summer, just be brazen and just go and knock on a few doors and ask a few people if they've got the capacity to take on some voluntary staff, and someone's bound to say yes at some point, and then you get a key bit of experience and you get to meet people, you get to network. I mean, I've met people that I don't just I work with on a day-to-day basis. I've met people from computer forensics, I've met developers, and it's just from basically people who deal with the business that I was working for. So it's all good. I mean, you will meet some nice people and genuine people who will help you. And if you get knocked back, you shouldn't be disheartened. You should just go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, and anyone who can't, who is not fortunate enough to find a position, even a voluntary position, there's still all this to fall back on. Like you said, like the likes of Metasploitable, PwnOS, stuff like that you can set up your own lab at home. Your own lab that you can follow a structured process to attack a system and just get your hands dirty and get some proper experience with it. Stop reading books and just start doing. It's stop reading, start doing. That's my philosophy, and that's how you learn the most.
I thought you were gonna bang the desk again there. Yeah.
There you go.
That's the one.
Give it socks.
Obviously we've talked about, you know, Metasploitable, and we've talked about some of the tools that you can use, like SQL map that was mentioned earlier, but there's other operating systems out there that can be used. I mean, I talked to a guy from Croatia who's developed Node Zero Linux. That's at netaffinity.org. It's a Ubuntu based distribution, again like Backtrack, but it's for someone who wants an Ubuntu distribution as the sort of main distribution with security tools, whereas anyone who's used Backtrack before, you know that you couldn't sit on Backtrack and, you know, do your day-to-day web browsing stuff that people like to do, because there's a lot of security measures in there, you know, that like no script, and obviously you can't read PDFs, Flash, you've got it all installed and stuff like that. And Node Zero is basically designed for people who want to have an Ubuntu desktop, like a main desktop, but also have all the security tools as well. And it's a nice bit of kit. And over the next couple of days, there's going to be a new release coming out.
Yeah, that's interesting. I understand what you're saying, because Backtrack is it's specifically a security orientated operating system. It's not designed to be a desktop, a general use desktop operating system. So I think, but I mean, for me, I like to have specific operating systems like Backtrack that I can just kick into and just do security stuff. And then when I just want to have a general desktop OS, I'll just stick on Debian, or I'll stick on Windows and gaming or whatever. I like the fact though that they're kind of weaning people as well towards security based distributions that still have desktop functionality. So that's definitely a plus.
I find it'd be handy for, you know, when you're sitting there on the web and you get a little bit curious and you think, oh, I wonder what that is, and then you think, oh, but I'll have to boot into Backtrack to find out, you know, and then you end up losing track of what little thing you found, because you think, oh, sod it, I can't be bothered to reboot or whatever, I'll just carry on doing what I'm doing. And then, you know, and it, as well, with one thing I always found annoying, a bit of a inconvenience with Backtrack is, you know, when you're doing passive enumeration and you do a bit of Google Docking and you're trying to find documents, PDF documents, you don't have your sort of Adobe Reader, well, not Adobe Reader, but you don't have your PDF reading documents on Backtrack. So I know you install them, but what I'm saying is, when you're doing passive enumeration, you want to find out a bit of information, you've got to actually go and get the software to read the PDFs that you're trying to enumerate to see if there's any sort of sensitive information in there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's obviously, once you install Backtrack, or if you run it from a live CD, that's why I install Backtrack as an actual, a real-time operating system, opposed to just running a live operating system from a CD. I install it so I can consistently have updates on it. I can update the Backtrack, code base, and I can add more features to it and kind of build it up to be an even more broad scale security distribution. So I think it's better off to install it. I mean, it's good the fact that you can have a CD, and people who are not comfortable installing Linux on their system, they can run it from the CD, and it kind of weans them into it. But I like to have it just installed on the actual hard drive itself. It runs a lot quicker, and you can do a lot more with it.
Yeah, Backtrack, it is a cool distribution. Everyone should try it, but there is alternatives, and Node Zero Linux is one of them. And if you want to have a look at that, it's netinfinity.org. I haven't just plugged it because I talked to a guy, but I think it is quite a good thing that's happening over there. So,
I'll definitely check it out anyways. Netinfinity.org. Yeah, I've got it here now. I'll just have a quick look just while I have you. This one actually appear to be loading, but then again, my internet's been terrible tonight, so. Oh yeah, Node Zero Linux. Yeah, I'll check it out. I'll bookmark it, and I'll have a toy around with it. I should be setting up, I'm going to try set up a new security challenge soon enough, within the next maybe 2 or 3 weeks. I'm not sure. I was considering coding a custom server, kind of akin to what Demo done, but I think Demo is probably the best guy for coding custom servers. I'm not sure if I trust someone having root like that on my network, on my home network. I mean, I could obviously segregate into its own subnet, but I prefer just coding security-based challenges, because I've a lot of experience now with PHP and coding security challenges with PHP. I've actually got, if anybody's interested, I'll post the code on the 2600s channel and on my Twitter, but I coded, it's a kind of a test bed for SQL injection. for practicing, and as I've said a lot, so you've got four different levels, and each level has got, you know, increasingly more filters as you go up the level. So it kind of weans you into SQL injection and filter evasion and stuff like that. It's a good way to get your hands dirty on some SQL injection.
Sounds really cool. Give me a shout and I'll have a.
You bounce. Can put actually if you put the source code up on inedison.org, that might be best.
Yeah, awesome, no problem, man.
Excellent.
There was something I was going to say, and it just completely went right out of my head. Have you noticed any speed up of your internet?
Have I noticed any speed up of my internet? In general, not really. I'm not sure.
Did you hear about the local change in the DNS servers? I had an article on it somewhere. Do you use Open DNS or Google DNS?
I was using Google DNS for a while, but I recently just reinstalled Windows, so I haven't configured. I must actually set it back up again, so I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, apparently I didn't read it properly. I was just sort of skimming through the article quickly. I had a million and one other things going on, but they've. There's some shit happened on the internet. Apparently it's meant to have made it a lot faster if you're using like OpenDNS or Google DNS.
Oh, okay. Well, I it probably won't make a difference to me because I've got I've a 50 meg cable connection, so it's everything's pretty much instant. which is a great upgrade from 56k.
I remember those days. I don't know. I kind of miss 56k days. I think with broadband, it's made me really impatient. Whereas, sort of 56k when you downloaded something, it was like a little reward at the end.
I remember I downloaded Slackware on 56k, and I think it took me a day and a half to download it. I used to download movies on 56k, at the time, the service I was using was IOL No Limits, Ireland Online No Limits, and when you were off peak, so from 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. in the morning, there was no tariffs, no charges, and then all weekend. So as soon as 6 p.m. hit on Friday, I'd start downloading a film, and it might be done Monday morning at 7:59 a.m. So that was 56k for you. I mean, obviously there was, even before that with the acoustic modems, it was a lot slower. But when I first got online, it was, you know, I had a 56k modem, yeah. And then I remember I got 512k broadband. You wouldn't even call it broadband now; it would be an insult to call it 512k broadbands. But now I've gone all the way up to 50 mega, and we even the ISP that I'm using offers 100 meg. But I don't see the need because I don't really download all that much. I might download some ISOs and stuff, but I don't download. And if I do download something, 50 meg takes us down quick enough. If I wanted a movie, I could have it down in 5 minutes, you know?
Yeah, I remember downloading Visual Basic 6, probably in 1999 or something, and it took like 24 hours to download 64 megs.
So horrible. I'm not sure. Do you remember Napster? For downloading the MP3s, and used to have. I had 56k, but I remember at the time everyone over in the States had like DSL and cable. They had like 1.5 meg and 3 meg. I was like, wow, 1.5 meg. That's crazy. That's just crazy fast. And here's me, my 56k taking like an hour to download one MP3. It's horrible.
I kind of miss the noise that the old modems used to make. Like squeal.
When you dial up, yeah.
It was like transcending the portal or the wormhole to the next realm.
the information superhighway. Yeah, you don't hear terms like that anymore, do you?
The information superhighway.
Yeah, you just don't hear that stuff anymore. But because a lot of people now are on the internet, they don't have the same issues that we had, I suppose, when we first got online. I mean, everything is instant from they start up their their laptop gets an IP via the HTTP from the router. It's done in literally split seconds. They open up the browser and they're connected to the internet before the browser even opens. So they don't have this anymore.
It's crazy the speeds that we get now, but you'll get people who will listen to this show and they'll be like, oh, well, I had a 300 baud modem. You want?
I know. And I said this, so we had 56k, we had it good compared to them, but now we're looking at today. I mean 50 meg, 100 meg, that's insane. I remember having a 10 meg ethernet cable, a 10 meg ethernet like network card. We used to play Half-Life 1, and before that we used to play I can't even remember half the games we used to play, but I remember playing Half-Life 1. We used to play that bounce level. I don't know if you played the original, but we used to play it on the LAN. We used to play the bounce level. And I remember you bounce up onto the cliff and you get the crossbow with the exploding darts. And whoever got up there first was obviously going to win, because there was no beating that thing. That thing was insane. But yeah, 10 meg. I had a 10 meg network card. And obviously before that, there would have been slower standards. But now... My broadband connection is faster than my first ever network card was, which is that's insane.
It is. It's all good stuff. I don't know. I kind of miss the old days of GeoCities sites. I'm feeling quite sentimental.
Yeah. Oh, I had a GeoCities website and I had a Homestead website. I had two websites because I was elite. GeoCities and Homestead. Do you remember getting the old domains, the CJB.net domains? Because they had You had CJB.net, and then they brought out .tk. You're like, oh, I've got my own top-level domain. My own domain, .tk, yeah.
Website was www.a-j.tuya.com.
Yeah, that was another one of those. Yeah, I remember, and you thought you were great. You're like, yeah, I've got a subdomain. I'm the real deal now, because before that was like geocities.com/blah-blah-blah-4. You know, so I remember the GeoCities, they had the GeoCities, my first GeoCities website. I remember at the time this must have been about 97 or 98. I was only getting into security. I remember I had the most cliche hacker website ever. And here was me. I didn't have a clue about security. And I was offering hacking advice on my website, like everyone else with their GeoCities website. It was like a black background with like neon green graphics. And it was like, yeah, I'm elite. I was like telling people like to use strong passwords and all this. I mean, at the time, but good times.
Well, we're on that too. Yeah, I remember years ago on Pal Talk, before it was, you know, all snazzy and jazzy and whatever, sort of thinking I was like some uber cool hacker because I had a Trojan that could steal people's nicknames. You know, when the first paid nicknames came out on that program.
Yeah.
And I pretended that I was a little slut who wanted to get my vagina on my webcam for some pervert. Basically had an exe file, and in the when you sent the file you could put loads of spaces and then
I remember that, yeah.
So you could name your file like boobies.jpg space recursive, and then how the exe would be off the screen. And then sent it over and I stole this guy's nickname. I thought I was the bee's knees.
I'm the real deal now. I'm a hacker. I used the Trojan. I remember I used Sub-7 for the first time when I put it was only out at the time, Sub-7. And I remember telling my friends at the time, oh yeah, I'm a hacker now. you know, like everyone else was saying that who was using Sub-7. Yeah, I'm a hacker now. I'm the real deal. And he's like, oh yeah, well how about you hack my computer? I'm like, yeah, I will sometime. I won't tell you what I'm doing. So I remember I sent him Sub-7 anyways, and I had access to his system and I was fucking around with him. He's like, wow, that's cool, man. That's really cool. And I thought it was cool. I thought it was elite. I thought it was, yeah, I must be the best hacker around, you know, using Sub-7. So it's amazing how far everyone comes along, you know, from those days. And that those days promote, they kind of encourage you to be lazy and not learn, because you're able to do so stuff like that so easy, like open someone's CD tray and you're like, yeah, I'm the real deal. But now you're encouraged to learn more, you know. And I think it's good.
Yeah, it's there is a swing in the community that's moving away from the, you know, the being disruptive side to sort of being knowledgeable and information sharing. And I think a lot of that's probably thankful to do with people like, you know, Emmanuel at 2600 and, you know, hacker spaces and conferences like Chaos Communication Camp.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the hacker spaces have really provided a great opportunity for people to come together and kind of like-minded people. Not even, I mean, because not everything that goes on in hacker spaces is related to security. You have just, I mean, people learn about electronics, but it is hacking. It's hacking in its truest sense, you know, learning about new things. I think the guys up in Dublin made a MAME cabinet, MAME emulator. At least one of the hackerspaces in Ireland that I was looking at it a while back. So it's bringing like-minded people together, and they can learn about stuff like lock picking, you know, electronics, you know, setting up the Arduino boards, you know, learning, you know, some assembler, and you know, it's really good that we have these things now. You know, we didn't have that before. You know, I remember meeting up with a guy I still know him to this day. We used to post on a website called Hack3R. Hack3R.com. I think it's still running, but they used to have a forum on there. I remember there was only like two of us from Ireland on there, so I'm like, yeah, we've got to meet up. And we met up for a pint, and we were offering each other advice about hacking and, you know, how great we were and how elite, but we obviously didn't know crap at the time. But we didn't have this avenue to come together like you have now with these hackerspaces. So I think it's really good, and it's bringing the community together, you know.
There's a hackerspace that's, well, they call it a makerspace. Obviously the make stuff, which is fair enough. That's just opened in my city. It's on the first and third Wednesday of the month. I haven't managed to get down there yet. I've got, you know, family commitments and stuff like that. But it'd be interesting to have a pop in sometime, just see what they're working on. I think I saw something mentioned about a 3D printer, which would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I saw one of those. They are pretty interesting. Yeah, they provided some sort of a 3D sculpture of an object, which is it's interesting. It's interesting to learn about all these things. I'm actually going to get an Arduino board myself and learn a little bit about that, because it's been something I've just been putting off for ages, because I've been reading about everything else besides like electronics and that. So I'm going to delve into that pretty soon. Actually, do you know what came in the mail for me today? It was a fossil kit. I'm going to go fossil hunting in a few days.
That's cool.
It's at a local, well, it's a beach. It's about, not really a beach, it's more of a cliff face. It's about 40 miles from me. It's called Hookhead. It's meant to be one of the top places in Ireland for fossils. So I'm going to go fossil hunting. I mean, I've always had an interest in kind of archaeology and dinosaurs and, you know, kind of primitive creatures and that. So I said, you know, fuck it, I'm going to get a fossil kit. So I got a fossil kit. So I'm going to go down. I'll be there on my own with my hammer and chisel, and I'll be hammering out fossils, and people will be looking at me as if I'm a weirdo, but I don't care, because that's the type of guy I am. I'm inherently curious, and I need to learn about, you know about stuff.
That's awesome. That sounds really interesting. I'm really sort of like middle-aged British history. Well, not just British, obviously, like, you know, Europe and stuff like that, and I really want to find some Roman coins.
Yeah, I've got an interest in coins myself, like the really old coins. What I want to do is get a collection of the old Irish coins before we switched over to the euro, because and the notes. I know you can get collections online, but it'd be nice to have them, because I mean they're inevitably going to get more scarce and more scarce. But it'd be nice to have them, because we're on the euro now 10 years, a decade of euro.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
Yeah, I know you guys didn't switch over to the euro. It's probably for the best, because it hasn't really worked out too well for us, unfortunately.
It hasn't worked out for a few places. I mean, Greece.
Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, Italy. Well, the only people it has worked out for is France and Germany.
Aren't they?
It's their project anyway.
That's what I was thinking. Two main instigators in the whole eurozone thing.
Oh, absolutely. The sooner we get out of it, the better, but I don't see it coming anytime soon. So I think on that note, we should wrap up. And we'll probably set up a podcast for sometime next week.
Yeah, cool. Definitely, definitely. Been a pleasure. It's been good.
Yes, it's been emotional. Yeah, so look, until next week, yeah, you can find the podcasts and all future podcasts on iunedison.org. If you want to spell that, Dick.
D-I-C-K.
So it's iunedison.org, and we'll put all the future podcasts up there. And I'll upload some source code as well, maybe some projects we've got going on to allow people to learn about hacking, maybe some SQL injection, some lab stuff like that.
As of the time of this podcast being recorded, there isn't actually a website on iunedison.org, so I have to get my finger out and build one, so that'll give me something to do over the next few days, and it'll be good because I need to get code ahead back on for going to university.
Excellent. So we'll get that up and running, and then we'll release the podcast. So until next week, it's been a pleasure, Dick.
Thanks very much.
No problem.